Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's Viewpoints, a rare and ambitious $1 billion conservation agreement is reached in British Columbia between First Nations and federal and provincial governments.
This is part of a historic moment in time. We've experienced this past year unprecedented drought, unprecedented wildfire season in Canada's history.
Scientists are releasing a beetle from the west coast into the wild in Nova Scotia. This in an effort to save hemlock trees.
We know the insect can find HWA in the field. We know it can eat it. You know, we know it can develop on it. But the one thing we don't know is whether or not it can actually survive the winters that can be sometimes quite harsh in Nova Scotia.
In Ontario, the 59th Six Nations elected council was sworn in on November 7th. Also in Ontario, Canadians celebrated Treaties Recognition Week.
There is no Canada without treaties, so I think everybody has an opportunity to express gratitude and then move that gratitude into thinking about, okay, yeah, I'm really grateful, but what am I doing about it?
And to Quebec, where a Royal Canadian Legion member hopes to bring his veteran grave marking project to a national level.
There's over 1,300 cemeteries in Quebec that veterans are buried in. Just to make people aware, the children today, they don't know what went on. We don't know them, but we certainly owe them.
Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Nice to have you with us. First Nations, federal and provincial governments have reached a $1 billion conservation agreement to protect BC's landscapes and species. The tripartite framework agreement on nature conservation aims to protect 30% of BC's land and waters by 2030. The main focus of the agreement is an old-growth forest. It also hopes to help sustain habitat for species in decline. A conference was held recently in Vancouver to announce the deal. BC Premier David Eby and elected regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations Terry Teague shared their thoughts on this historic agreement, the details with Scott Anishuk in Nelson, BC.
On Friday, November 3rd, a conservation agreement was reached by the federal government, the provincial government of British Columbia, and First Nations that will see $1 billion in funding, support protecting 30% of lands and waters in British Columbia by 2030. Robin Duncan of WildSight says this is the first time we've seen First Nations recognized as significant decision makers in this type of agreement.
A really historic agreement that we haven't seen kind of the scale of this investment in conservation here in BC ever before. And most importantly, we haven't seen the recognition of First Nations as decision makers and as title and rights holders to be so central and as signatory to this type of agreement. So a really, really great day here in BC.
This agreement is meant to protect old growth forests in BC, which will also help biodiversity and recovery of species at risk. Duncan outlined several species that have either left the Kootenays due to habitat destruction or are in decline because of it.
Here in the Kootenay region, we've lost many mountain caribou local populations. So we've seen at least 7 local herds extirpated or declared locally extinct in our region. And other wildlife populations are also experiencing declines, Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, mountain goats, you name it. And that, of course, is going hand in hand with habitat loss as the main driver of that. So what this agreement does is start to lay out a pathway where we can realize on-the-ground conservation in partnership with First Nations that will lead to long-term habitat protection and also habitat restoration, because we have a lot of habitat that's been impacted but that still has real possibility to support wildlife populations.
A conference was held in Vancouver on Friday to announce the new deal called the Tripartite Framework Agreement on Nature Conservation. BC Premier David Eby said economic prosperity and protecting nature go hand in hand.
For many years, we were told in this province you had to choose. You have to choose between economic development and prosperity on the one hand and protecting the environment, protecting these spaces for generations to come on the other hand. Now we know very clearly that these things are not separate, they are linked.
Terry Teague, the elected regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations, also spoke at the conference saying First Nations need to be a part of the decision-making process.
This is part of a historic moment in time. We've experienced this past year unprecedented drought, unprecedented wildfire season in Canada's history, and certainly a part of that is conserving biodiverse areas in our respective territories and in British Columbia. But I think fundamentally, we need to be a part of the decision-making process.
That was Scott Anishank reporting in Nelson, British Columbia. Canadian scientists are hoping that a beetle imported from British Columbia will be able to stop a pest which is threatening hemlock trees across Nova Scotia. The hemlock woolly adelgid, or HWA, is a small aphid-like insect that kills hemlock trees by eating the food and water that the tree stores at the base of its needles. Dr. Lucas Roscoe is part of a Canadian Forest Service team that is bringing a beetle called the Larobocius beetle from British Columbia to Nova Scotia in hopes it will be effective in eradicating HWA. Roscoe says 3,000 of them have been collected and brought to Nova Scotia this fall to determine if they can survive the province's colder climate over winter. The Larobocius beetles have been released in several locations across Queens and Shelburne countries and just outside Bridgewater, Nova Scotia. Ed Alverson is in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. He spoke to Dr. Lucas Roscoe.
You were just in Kitchen-McCoojick and working on a new project, so I'll just get you to dive in and describe what kind of work you're doing over there.
Sure. So the project that we're conducting in Kitchen-McCoojick and also some other places in southwestern Nova Scotia is studying the feasibility of using a biological control agent, which is a type of insect that we can import and will hopefully serve as a long-term management tool for hemlock woolly adelgid in Nova Scotia. So This month, what we were able to do was collect the beetles. They're originally from British Columbia. Hemlock woolly adelgid is also from British Columbia. Hemlock woolly adelgid is not a problem in British Columbia because these beetles are out there and they're able to regulate populations to densities that they're not an economically big problem out there, and they don't kill the trees. One of the reasons why hemlock woolly adelgid is a problem in Nova Scotia is that the trees here have no defense against them, and there's no predators that actually attack hemlock woolly adelgid. And because of that, there's no limits on their population growth and their populations can spike, which is what we're seeing. So the goal of what we were trying to do here was to see if this beetle that is from BC and only attacks and develops on HWA, it doesn't do it for any other insect but HWA. It's specialized just HWA. Mm-hmm. We're seeing if we can actually get populations potentially on the ground in Nova Scotia and see if they can actually survive in the next year.
Okay. But the idea of doing this in the winter is to see if they can, the overwinter, is that the idea? Is that your concern about the cold?
Yep, that's a major concern, not just with this program, but any program in the world like this. Is we know the insect can find HWA in the field. We know it can eat it. You know, we know it can develop on it. But the one thing we don't know is whether or not it can actually survive the winters that can be sometimes quite harsh in Nova Scotia. And the goal of what we were doing this fall and into this winter is to kind of put populations out there and see if we can actually recover them in the spring. So we're planning on doing some sampling during the winter and again in the spring.
So how many of the beetles and what kind are they that you're trying to establish here?
Sure. So the beetle itself is called Larobocius. It's similar to like a ladybug, not as big as a ladybug, and actually about the size of a pinhead. It's about, you know, 2, maybe 3 millimeters long. They're small, they're black. They're pretty nondescript. They're a really important predator of hemlock woolly adelgid. What we did is we tried to get them from British Columbia and bring them to Nova Scotia. We only have so much time to get them in British Columbia because they're only an adult, which we collect the adults off of trees. We can only collect them, you know, at a certain time of year, which is this time of year. We're hoping for about 3,000 beetles. These beetles are shipped to Nova Scotia, and they're being released primarily in Queens County and also Shelburne County, and then also outside of Bridgetown, or Bridgewater, sorry.
Right, right. How is it settled that it only attacks the hemlock woolly adelgid?
So in the United States, they've been dealing with hemlock woolly adelgid for, you know, like probably 70 years. So they first found it in the 50s, and they've been working on it ever since. We only found HWA in 2017 here. And in the States, they came to the conclusion after about 60 years of research that using a beetle like Larobocius was the best bet for controlling HWA. And what they did is they did a lot of really intensive but really good peer-reviewed science on the insect itself. And they did an experiment called non-target host testing. And what this was is they would just take beetles and just simply put different insects, different potential food sources in front of it, and then measure how much food they actually ate. Mm-hmm. So there's several insects that are kind of similar to HWA, not exactly the same, but similar type, similar size, that kind of thing. And what they found is that Laricobius only completed development on hemlock woolly adelgid. It might go near another, you know, adelgid species, you know, might, you know, smell it, taste it, that kind of thing, but then it wouldn't do anything else. And what's good about Laricobius is it only completes development on HWA and only really eats HWA. So it doesn't affect any other type of insect. So things like, you know, bees, you know, are pollinators, nothing like that. It only attacks HWA. And that's what we're really interested in. And this work has been, you know, the basis and kind of the foundation that the program in the United States has been built upon. And they've been doing this for 20 years. And we have a lot of collaborators that we talk to regularly in the United States about Laricobius and also hemlock woolly adelgid management in general. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of a consensus that we all said, okay, this is probably our best bet. So not just us with the federal government, but we've been liaising with constantly and the entire time with, you know, Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources and Renewables, Department of Environment and Climate Change. And we've all been working together on this program, since HWA was discovered.
Yeah.
This insect has been, it's been extensively tested and vetted. And if there was any, you know, potential, or if there was anything in the literature that said, you know, there's a strong non-target effect, like it eats this other insect, we wouldn't have gone near it. But this is going to be, you know, a 10 plus year project. And what we're doing at CFS is we're trying to develop tactics that, you know, Nova Scotia can then apply to their forests, like complete all the research they need, and then they can then come up with some sort of program to continue this. But what we're hoping is that these initial releases will actually lead to populations that can self-replicate. And that's another benefit of this, is that once the insects are out there, they can, you know, create their own populations, and they'll follow HWA across the landscape. So we don't have to do releases every year, potentially. They can just self-replicate.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
In Ontario, the 59th Six Nations Elected Council was sworn in on November 7th. The new 12-member council and chief elect took the oath. The newly elected council increased its complement by 3 additional councillors. Newly elected chief Sherry Lynn Hill says the 59th council will have a 2-month transitional period, something she says has never been done before. David Moses is in Nashwaukin, Ontario. He was present at the ceremony.
The swearing-in of the 59th Six Nations Elected Council took place on Tuesday, November 7th at 6 p.m. at the Elected Council Chambers on Chiefswood Road. The seating area for observers was at capacity as the new 12-member council and elected chief took the oath.
And will in no way betray the people's trust. Should I break my oath, I shall be willing to submit myself to disciplinary action and accept the penalty as determined by the Integrity Commission. This is my solemn oath.
The 59th Elected Council has increased its complement by 3 additional councillors. It's a change that returning councillor Greg Fraser suggested would have a positive effect for the community, as heard in this interview he did with CKRZ just prior to the election.
Sure, I know going from 9 councillors, as you know, to 12 will be helpful. I thought the workload on 9, you see me in the community, Dave, having different files put upon less people is difficult. It's time consuming. And I think that with a newer system that we have coming in, more of a portfolio type of system that will allow all our members to concentrate in certain areas, get the information, promote it, get it to council, get decisions making, get it back into those programs and regions of their expertise, I think it's going to be helpful.
Newly elected Chief Sherry Lynn Hill mentioned in a passing conversation with me that this council will be doing something she is not aware has ever been done before, and that is to have a two-month transitional period.
I just want to ask you, because you mentioned something about a transitional period or exchange.
Yes.
So you said that was something that hadn't been done before. I just wondered if you wanted to elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, the next couple months that this council will be in transition to be able to know what policies and governance is for the next couple months. So I'm excited, and they're going to have all the tools to be able to move forward.
So what do you think that will mean for the community? What can they expect out of the next couple of months then from that transitional area?
We're still going to have business as usual, but also still they're going to have all the information that they'll need to know.
Sitting next to me in the audience was Brantford Mayor Kevin Davis. He mentioned how the Six Nations elected council has more women than his own.
There is a greater matriarchal representation on this council than my council, though we did improve from one to three.
Okay.
So we're making progress, but we're not as far down that road as Six Nations elected council is. I'm definitely here supporting Six Nations. There's a lot we were working on, a lot of initiatives with Chief Mark Hill.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to continuing that momentum with the new chief, Sherilyn Hill. A lot of important issues for both the nation and in my community, and then I look forward to working with this new council.
A media conference is scheduled with the new elected chief on Wednesday, November 8th at 10 a.m., also taking place inside the council chambers, where she will explain her vision and plans moving forward for the Six Nations territory. I'm David Moses.
Listening to Viewpoints with Forrest Sasang.
And we stay in Ontario, where Canadians are participating in the 2023 Treaty Recognition Week. This annual event honors the importance of treaties and helps students and Ontario residents as well learn more about treaty rights and relationships. The Ontario government passed legislation in 2016 recognizing the first full week of November as Treaties Recognition Week. Some local schools, districts in Ontario are going further than that by putting an emphasis on Indigenous education and culture during the whole month of November, such as the case in the Upper Grand District School Board, which has over 100 classes, already signed up for a series of webinars. Some will be doing live streams featuring multiple Indigenous voices, such as Isaac Murdoch of Serpent River First Nation and Shannon Paul, an artist from Treaty 3 and Northwest Angle 33 in Lake of the Woods, Ontario. They will share their perspectives with students. This event isn't just about one day, week, or month, as we learn from Riley Gillespie Wilson in Fergus, Ontario.
Treaty Week in local school boards will feature webinars from several Indigenous community members, including Isaac Murdoch of Serpent River First Nation. Over 100 classes within the Upper Grand District School Board, or UGDSB, have already signed up. The webinars will also feature Shannon Paul, an artist from Treaty 3, Northwest Angle No. 33 in Lake of the Woods, Ontario. Five live streams will be viewed by students throughout the region and focus on different subjects, including how treaties are important in understanding Indigenous veterans and how treaties are not just a human-to-human relationship. The Treaty Week 2023 website states, in 2016, Ontario passed legislation recognizing the first full week of November as Treaties Recognition Week. This annual event honors the importance of treaties and helps students and residents of Ontario learn more about treaty rights and relationships. Since 2020, Robinson Huron has used this opportunity to educate students and community members, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, about the Robinson Huron Treaty of 1850 and the work being done in the territory to establish a treaty-level governance body to address treaty-specific issues as well as efforts to return to traditional governance systems. When it comes to land, Indigenous Program Lead at UGDSB, Jerrica Fraser, says ensuring livable land for future generations is paramount.
I'm always very mindful about how am I acting in ways that I will ensure that my great-great-great-great-great-grandnieces and nephews will be able to have land that they can live on.
Fraser says recognizing the relationship is critical between board members and their nearest treaty partner. Marking Indigenous Remembrance Day is a webinar on treaty remembrance. The Freedom on the Land live stream will allow students to ask questions of presenters. Fraser says the country we live in wouldn't be what it is if not for treaties.
There is no Canada without treaties. So I think everybody has an opportunity to express gratitude and then move that gratitude into thinking about, okay, yeah, I'm really grateful, but what am I doing about it?
Fraser added, bettering relationships with Indigenous circles won't happen without some persistence.
How Indigenous people are inseparable from the land, I think is really, really important for people to understand, is that we will always be here and we really want to better that relationship. But it takes work. It takes action.
The live streams, Fraser pointed out, are available the whole month. This isn't just about November, though, she said, adding it's more than just a one-and-done week or day. I'm Riley Gillespie-Wilson.
A Royal Canadian Legion member in the Eastern Townships of Quebec wants to bring his veteran grave marking project to a national level. Arnold Raymond, a member of the Phillipsburg Legion Branch 82, has been working on a veteran grave marker project with the goal of expanding it nationwide, hopefully in time for next year's Remembrance Day. Raymond has been a volunteer with the Royal Canadian Legion in Phillipsburg, Quebec since 2013, and shortly after becoming a member, he discovered that his grandfather served in the Canadian Armed Forces in the First World War. After visiting his gravesite, he decided to create a marker that would clearly identify his grandfather as a veteran. While soldiers buried overseas have grave markers indicating they fought for the Commonwealth, there is no marker on Canadian graves identifying a fallen soldier's final resting place. Raymond wants to change this. Journalist Taylor McClure, based in Knowlton, Quebec, sat down with Arnold Raymond and also with Edith Dandeneau, a project volunteer, to discuss the Veteran Grave Marker project.
On Remembrance Day, I went to the cemetery to visit my grandfather's cemetery grave. And it was a bunch of my classmates there. And they were all there visiting their parents that served our country in war. And there was nothing indicating their service to their country. So right then and there, I decided I should make a grave marker for my grandfather. And it caught on. Other members that I went school, members I went school with was there, and they wanted to get on too. So we started marking graves. Then it was six of us volunteered to do this on our own. And we're all a product of a veteran. And we've been marking graves ever since. Grave markers is to identify the veterans that served and are buried in our cemeteries that are not recognized in the cemeteries. There's over 1,300 cemeteries in Quebec that veterans are buried in, but there's nothing there to identify them as a veteran to show the people or visitors or their family member the service they've done to their country and bring us where we are today.
So you wanted to make that clear for those people who walked through the cemeteries?
Yes. Yes, and I'd like to expand this project nationwide. This is my personal goal, to make this happen for everybody. Well, I never knew my grandfather. He died a year before I came into this world. But I found out afterwards, after I became a Legion member, that he served in the First World War. That was only 8 years ago I learned about this. And it's not right. I think I should have known about that before. And I don't know. There's a lot of people in my case throughout this country that don't know. And I think these markers should be in the cemetery identifying these people whenever, or anybody that visits the cemeteries to visit their loved ones to see that there's a veteran. Mm-hmm. There's a veteran. Just to make people aware. The children today, they don't know what went on. They're not aware who served. To make them aware and to educate them more of the service that our people did and served the country to give us what we have today, all the peace and freedom we have today, we owe them a lot. We don't know them, but we certainly owe them.
There's a big tie-in with the way schools are going right now. The federal programs are across the country are trying to get kids to start thinking about the Second World War, the First World War, yes. What it meant, and even the wars since then. And now in a time where there are other wars going on around the world, there are people dying. And I thought, Arnold was right, the idea that even if I don't have military family, for me to be able to walk into a cemetery anywhere and just see a recognizable marker, something that would say, this person whose gravestone you're looking at served this country, to preserve our values or to make sure that to save other lives somewhere around the world. I thought that's something that would touch me, but it's something that is in line with what a lot of the programming that's going on in schools, and I'm a teacher, so it's something that I thought, oh, that's a good tie-in.
All the people that served in this country that died overseas are all identified with the Commonwealth Grave Commission, but nothing in this country. And that's my goal, is to get them all identified.
So a Canadian soldier who's fallen abroad has a marker. A Canadian soldier that perhaps didn't die on the wherever the battle was fought, made it back here and then died, or was brought back here, repatriated for some reason here, there's no marker to indicate that they were military.
Now, how did you make these wonderful markers, Arnold?
I was using the poppy on the beginning, and I was told I have to go get permission from different identities all the way up through to the Dominion Command to be able to use the poppy on this. I didn't think that was right because it's my grandfather. I want to identify him. So I sat down with a piece of paper and a pencil and I drew this.
Okay, so you created this.
This is mine and it's copyrighted. That has been put on every leaf since. I don't have to ask anybody's permission. It's mine.
Maybe you would like to describe it to our listeners who can't see it?
Well, the background is a maple leaf, a colored maple leaf on a stainless steel maple leaf. It shows us a soldier holding his weapon, head down, and a banner across the bottom says veterans in both languages, and je me souviens, and we'll never forget, well, at least we forget on top. It's colored, it's black, yellow, red for the leaf.
They worked so hard, he and his team of volunteers, to make it so that it would be big enough that it could be recognizable and solid and sturdy, but also light enough that it could travel through Canada for, you know, a reasonable price, and that it wouldn't be expensive to mail, and that people could actually tuck it into things like a smaller gravestone or a larger gravestone. It's really quite nice. And the image, when Arnold brought it to me, it's so simple and yet so clear. You can't possibly misunderstand what this is. And even somebody who could walk into any cemetery and have never heard of this project, they may be able to walk right up to the gravestone and just read veterans, and know right away, oh, this was someone who served in the military. It's self-explanatory. What makes a project solid.
Now, Arnold, you were mentioning how you wanted to bring this to the national level, so maybe you wanted to speak on the future goals for the project a little bit more and how you plan on maybe doing that.
Last week, I made a list of what I want to do for next year, and starting the 19th of this month, we're having a district meeting. I'm going to present this at a district meeting. In March next year, I want to have everything ready to be boxed. Right now, we're working on all the names and addresses of legions across Canada. Everything east of Manitoba we have. We're still working on Western Canada, Northwest Territories, and the Yukon. And we're hoping to get them between now and the time we kick this off in May. By next Remembrance Day, send them all a marker, along with a little pamphlet saying, offer these to your community. If they want one, they can buy it through that legion, and we'll be shipping it to that legion. They can pick it up at that legion. I want this to be a national thing.
And a footnote to let you know that November 8 was Indigenous Veterans Day in Canada. Dive into canada-info.ca to check out the stories produced by some 30 journalists feeding our website with their daily stories. And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists David Moses, Taylor McClure, Riley Gillespie-Wilson, Ed Alverson, and Scott Unshuck. National editors Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Great to have you with us. Please stay tuned to what follows. See you next week. Ciao.
diverse.